So for all the listeners in England, this is Hayden speaking.
That's right. Hayden has joined us graciously on the score report. Brita is out. She has mom duty and couldn't join us. Jay is here.
Hi. And, hello, internet. There. Get the obligatory. The obligatory greeting.
We haven't talked to Hayden in a while.
And, it's very sad because he brings that British accent that just makes it so much more classy. Yeah.
That sounds like a Gloucester accent.
it's more of a Long Island, but
since we last spoke, Hayden has purchased a rifle.
Yes, I got my very own AR-15. It's been bitterly cold here in Ohio, so I haven't yet taken it to the range. But what I have been is I put a red dot sight on, and I have a corridor in my house that is about 25 good steps. So I've been sort of, I got a laser bore, and I put the scope, and I can see the two red dots, one from obviously the laser scope and one from the red dot. And I've been sort of trying to get the dots in the right place. Of course, I am an utter amateur at this. This is my very first rifle ever.
That's awesome.
It is.
I hear the battle hymn of the Republic.
I know.
The
I got goosebumps. It was great. And what a great first rifle too. I mean, you know, it is not uncommon in the U.S. or at least it didn't used to be. I don't know what it is nowadays, but you know, lots of times you when you're a kid, you start out with like a BB gun, and then you get like a single shot 22 or something like that. But man, to just jump right in and snag an AR for your first rifle, that's pretty good.
It's an absolute beauty. I know how much, my wife chose it. My wife, paid for it. Obviously I did the paperwork, but, I don't know how much it was because she sort of shooed me away, when to pay it. So it was, there was a little note with a spec in. So it's 16 something barrel, 16 inch barrel. It's got a 1-in-7 twist. It's completely flat on the top, so it doesn't have that sort of triangle thing that's very, I've seen others have on the front. Right, it does not have that.
Okay, so that's the front sight.
Okay, right, yep. What else? It has the button on the side that you push to make to seat the. I'm not using the right words, and you're going to have to help.
It's the forward assist.
Okay, superb. Yes, so
you push, and it pushes the bolt all the way in if it's not completely seated.
Right, it has one of those.
I'm sorry, Hayden. I love this stuff, and I'm geeking out really big. So forgive me if I jump in.
No, please. So yes, 1-in-7 twist. My wife who's an American but has not really grown up with this since and has been a bit more interested obviously since we got married, because I've come from a country where it's all gone, you know, this idea of a magazine and the bullets and the gun would just, you know, let alone a rifle, it would, I'd get 5 years in prison. So, rather than coming to, coming to America and having the attitude of, I'm going to be scared of something I've never done, seen, touched, held, had the privilege of, I took the complete alternative. I thought this is a fascinating opportunity, and we'll went to it like I'm trying to think of a nice analogy that I know Alan has a very expensive camera with a very expensive lens and is clearly good at photography, but everyone has to have their very first camera. Everyone has to, you know, buy something that they can afford and then get good at it. You know, you get good at the cheap one, and then you, you know, you eventually buy the, you know, a better, you know, one more lens. And then you realize that the first camera you bought is no longer adequate, and you then buy a better camera and buy three lenses.
Oh, yeah.
And you can then sort of, you know, take your camera to the zoo and take photographs of the nose hairs on the giraffes and things like that. because you have such a powerful camera. And that's the analogy that perhaps you know, is that I'm coming from, is that this is a fascinating sport. It's a fascinating hobby. I want to be part of it. So, you know, I've done a little bit of pistol shootings. I got Walther's. They seem to be a good brand. Highly, you know, they seem to be used by Olympians. Clearly there's something in there. So the rifle I got was not, I don't think it was expensive. I don't know how much, I don't know how much it was, because obviously I said my wife shooed me away. I think it's going to be, you know, like my first camera, you know, like, you know, a person has their very first camera, they get good at, you know, with what they have to start with. I think is, but yes, I've really tried my best to, I bought a DVD, and this might seem, an interesting when you have the whole sort of internet and YouTube available, a gentleman called Kyle Lamb, as in you know, LAMB, his surname, and he has a DVD of specially made for first people with their AR-15, and I bought that DVD and I've watched it. He said, you know, this is how the safety catch works. This is how you load it. This is how you put the magazine in. Which I'm sure. You know, this is all sort of, yes, I've done that hundreds of times.
Yep. but if you've never done it before, the AR is a little confusing.
Right. Yes.
Just wait till the first time you take it apart to clean it.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I need to buy some things for that. I don't have anything to clean it with whatsoever.
don't put it in the dishwasher. That's a misnomer.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that.
Yes, it doesn't go in the machine. It doesn't go in the dishwasher. What I found with my first AR was I was over cleaning. Really, for most of the time, you can get by with just cleaning the barrel thoroughly. I'm a big fan of a 22 caliber bore snake. It's very easy. You soak it in solvent, run it through a few times, and it's nice and clean. Pull the bolt carrier group out, clean it off, spray it with CLP. That's cleaner lubricant protectant. And for your, you know, if you go to the range and shoot 100 rounds, you can do that 3 or 4 times before you have to get any more detailed. And for a lot of people, that's a year.
Well, I went and bought some bullets for it. I looked online and I went to sort of the local mom and pop. Did I say that right? Mom and pop shop. And the price difference between online and them was, it was after shipping, it was about $10. I thought I'd rather give my custom to the to the people that have the shop. So I went and bought 5,000 bullets, which is, I God knows how long it's going to last me. A year, maybe 2 years, 3 years. I don't know. and I got some. I got some magazines. I also, out of curiosity, bought a 10-round magazine because I realized that it would fit almost flush with the magazine well, and therefore I can prop the. This is what I saw the gentleman on the DVD do. He had a sandbag, and obviously I'm not going to buy a sandbag. I'm just going to take an old pillow, but he seemed to use. I could use that as a sort of a to stiffen whilst I. Do the first sort of, rounds, and just a 10 round magazine is not going to, is not going to sort of affect the balance, I think.
Yeah. Almost every rifle range you go to will have, bags, like they'll have sandbags or lead shot bags or something like that you can use, for that kind of thing. And I actually do the same thing, Hayden. When I go to the range, I don't use my 30 round mags because they stick down too far. So when I'm using like a bipod or a bean bag, I use like a 10 or 20 round mag. Those work great.
I don't use a 30 round mag typically because I'm cheap and I shoot too much ammunition too quickly. I do want to take a quick step back because I know Alan will geek out about this. My first camera was a Kodak Instamatic X15.
Wow.
Now let's see if Alan remembers those.
Yeah. Did it have the little flash cube thing on top?
It did with the 126 film.
Those are great. The great thing about those cameras, in fact, one of the downsides to going to digital from film is that, By the time film became almost obsolete, film was so good that it was you had to go out of your way to take a photograph that could not be discerned. Now, it may not be good, but even the cheap throw. I mean, they literally had disposable cameras. You remember? I mean,
absolutely.
You take the camera with the pack of film in it, and you basically threw the camera away and developed the film. So, and they tried to do that with digital cameras for a while too. I mean, they made like a disposable, quote, disposable digital camera, but that just, that never took off. So, yeah.
See, now I'm wondering if I could find one of the Instamatic bodies and put a cheap, point and shoot digital inside of it.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be fun.
That would be awesome. That would be an awesome project.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. It just, it clicked when you said you're like buying your, Alan has this expensive camera and, you have a starter camera.
We could spend a whole show talking about cameras and stuff.
I don't
even want to go there. it's because I bore everyone to tears. But I was going to mention, Hayden, you're the big difference is that the AR at this point in time, it is almost impossible to buy a crappy AR.
Yes.
I mean, just about anything you're going to buy at a gun store is going to be a very decent a rifle that will be perfectly adequate for any purpose you want to put it through you'll probably have that rifle for the rest of your life and not think that you need to upgrade from it. Now you might get other ones and you might wind up with a safe full of them like Jay does, but there's something about your first rifle. I still have my first rifle. I bet Jay still has his first rifle.
I absolutely do.
And it's the one you never get rid of, no matter what. Hmm. I mean, I've bought rifles, I've traded them and stuff like that, but my first 22, it's Marlin 39A lever action, and I had it since I was 10, and it's you just you know, it's your first rifle. You never get rid of it.
Huh. It was, I went to a gun show with one of our listeners, and I almost bought a Lee Enfield as my first rifle, partly because of the Britishness. Yes. A gentleman who clearly had more money in his pocket than I did at the time, quite literally stepped up to the table, said to the gentleman, "How much is it for this?" It did not have a label on. The gentleman said a number, and he said "sold" and pulled out his wallet, and I quite literally got bought underneath me. I thought, even though it was, oh, okay, it's not to be. I shall. But I was with the same actual gun show. I was walking around again with this listener. It was actually a wonderful day, because I got to walk around the gun show with someone who clearly knows a lot more than I did at the time, and we were. We're looking at some ARs, and they were ridiculously cheap. There was it's like $500 and $400 I saw, and this was about nine. It was last summer, so yes, it was interesting to sort of to see everything. And I've actually had a. Been walk around a gun show with Breeder and her husband as well, and that was nice. There was some it was interesting because Breeder was pointing out that the guns that were clearly not, you know, sort of the pinks and the and those, you know, she was saying, "These are these are quite horrible. These are gaudy," and I had to agree with her. I thought, you know, clearly it was a sort of a trend, but it's just, yes, they are absolutely fascinating. You know, it's just sort of as a culture thing, and perhaps, you know, perhaps some people say people watching as well. I don't know if it's a, you know, I don't know if some people go for there as people watching, but I was certainly, you know, fascinated at the, that it was, there was no boundaries of the people there. It was, you know, there was no social class. It was, you know, those people that, you know, had money to spend, and those that, you know, apart from appearance, didn't seem to be incredibly wealthy, but were all, you know, all there and all sort of, you know, at these events. I thought it was quite fascinating how it brought a community together.
Yeah, that's the great thing about the shooting sports in general, and you see it. Like you mentioned, you see it at the gun shows. In fact, if liberals want to see, you know, diversity in action, all they have to do is open their eyes and go to a good gun show in a big city. And you literally see, like you said, you see everybody from everywhere. There are literally millionaires who look like street bums that are dropping money left and right buying rifles. And there's, you know, there's guys that, you know, have saved for 3 or 4 years and, you know, to go in and buy a rifle to, you know, go deer hunting with or something. You know, it's just, there's all kinds of people. It's a great, and, you know, I've never seen the kind of diversity, you know, not just in race, but in, you know, we like to think we don't have classes in the U.S., but we do. And you know, you step up to the rifle line and you know, whether you're going to just go plank or, you know, shoot in a league or, you know, something like that. And you have all kinds of people that you're going to run into there. It's really great. It's one of the great things. It is, and you know, it's not just shooting. You see this in other hobby activities, you know, something similar, but it is a great, slice of Americana.
Well, I think it's a sport that's open to everyone. I've been watching the Winter Olympics, and you know the people going down, you know, those half pipe things. I mean, I've been joking at the television, going, "Well, clearly there's, you know, lots of life transferable skills there." but at the same time, I can't go down a half pipe and do it, you know, without coming like as, you know, coming out mangled at the bottom.
I was going to say, you can go down it, Hayden.
Right. Yeah, gravity is not optional.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But at the same time, you know, if I was in a wheelchair, I'm not in a wheelchair, but if I was in a wheelchair, clearly it'd be hard for me to go down a half pipe at the Winter Olympics. It would take a lot of skill and a lot of to become that way. But a person in a wheelchair can easily go to a shooting range and get very, very good at shooting. And someone who does not have a lot of disposable income can go to a shooting range and only own ever one gun and become very, very good at it. There's no, if you don't have a lot of upper body strength, you can go to a shooting range and become incredibly good at it. There's no boundary to the sport.
Yep. Yeah, that's, yeah, you see, you're absolutely right. You can literally, I mean, there are literally people that have no arms that shoot. There are people that have one arm that shoot. There's people that I know, you know, there are people that can barely open a jar of pickles and they're out there shooting, you know. So it literally, as long as you have enough body strength to hold the pistol or rifle, that's literally all it takes. Can you hold a 4-pound thing in your hand for a minute or two and suddenly you are equal to the biggest gym rat weightlifter there ever was, you know? there's a reason they called it the great equalizer.
You beat me to it, Alan.
Oh, sorry, Jay.
God created man, but Samuel Colt made him equal.
That's right. There's a lot of truth to that.
What else can I tell you about my AR?
Well, you haven't shot it yet, right?
No. Okay. The weather here has been utterly bitter.
So you're getting pretty itchy to go shooting, I would imagine.
I am. Yes, I am. I am. I am. I am.
Well, that we will have to have you back on after you shoot it, so you can talk about that.
Oh, yes,
I am interested to hear it. Now they will let you back in the UK now that you're a rifle owner, right? as long as you don't bring it with you.
I have a rucksack that that sometimes I take, you know, my possessions back to England every time. I tip it upside down and shake the pieces out of it. I open the pockets. I put my finger in the pocket. I tell my wife, put your finger in this pocket. She likes it. Looks at it. And tell me if you touch anything brass.
No brass, no knives, no.
Nothing.
So. That's it's just I'm just interested. I'm always interested in people that come to this later in life. I mean, I've grown up with it. I think Jay grew up with it to a certain extent. You know, I've been around guns and shotguns all my life. So I'm always fascinated to talk to somebody who didn't and is approaching it from a new perspective. And frankly, I'm a little jealous.
Yes.
Because the options and the for a new shooter today are so overwhelmingly amazing. You know, from I mean, what I remember, you know, when I was, you know, learning how to shoot, it was, you know, there was no internet, there were no videos, there was no, you know, nobody had a scope, no, there were no optics, there was no laser sights, there's no indoor ranges, there's
in Alan's defense, they hadn't been invented yet, so
you know, it's you know, people back in this, I'm talking about the 70s and stuff, people went deer hunting with iron sights, you know. I mean, some what? they had, you know, some people had rifle scopes and stuff, but I mean, there was a lot of, you know, it was less common. Nowadays, if somebody's going deer hunting or something like that with a rifle, they got a scope. That's almost nobody goes hunting without a scope anymore. But back then, it was all iron sights and of course, you know, I don't think I can even see the front sight on my rifles anymore. I need a scope just to go shooting. But you know, it's just, things are different. I mean, ARs existed when I was a kid, but nobody had one. You know, that was a military rifle. They were rare as hen's teeth. In fact, it's actually funny, you know, remember the assault weapons ban, the 1994 assault weapons ban. Prior to that, you know, AR style rifles were very rare. Not many people had one. And then the assault weapons ban happened. Everybody went, well, damn, I need to get one of those.
That's right. The surest way to get an American to buy something is to tell them they can't have it.
Boy, isn't that the truth? So now Hayden gets to, you know, buy an awesome rifle for his first rifle and, you know, gets to learn all this stuff all, you know, for the first time. And it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like reading a really good book for the first time. And you know, once you're done with it, you're kind of like, man, I wish I could like forget all that and do it over again. You know,
do it again.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, I wish I could, you know, maybe I wouldn't pick up so many bad habits if I was starting afresh. But I'm proud of you, Hayden. That's really great.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. Very kind.
I'm glad you're jumping in to the deep end.
And it's a really, I'm a huge fan of the AR-15 platform. It's a great rifle. It's accurate. It's light. It doesn't kick. It's very good. It's loud. That's the other thing. Do you have an outdoor range? That's why you haven't, haven't shot it. But you know, even outdoors, it can be loud. Just be aware. Right.
Definitely wear your your protection.
Yes, I've been to a few indoor ranges, and there seems to be. First of all, the percussion against the stone walls I always find distracting. I'm not making myself very clear. Not the flash or the bang, but the sort of the. I just find it overloads my senses with this sort of the sound then coming back at you. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, concussion is exactly correct.
Yep.
So I prefer going to outdoor ranges because obviously the sound then just escapes into the air, and I don't get that. it's not claustrophobia, but it's sort of you just don't get that. There's been a few times I've gone to an indoor range, and quite frankly, the muzzle discipline of the people in there scares me.
Yeah.
I just sort of I prefer going to outdoor ranges. My wife does too. I think she sort of feels she said to me that she prefers the outdoor range because there isn't someone standing right next to her that she feels is judging her ability to shoot, which obviously in an indoor range, you have the lane right next to you and, you know, and each side. I think that's her newness to the sport and, you know, and to the hobby. You know, she feels that outdoors it's,
yeah. You know what? Yes. We should have a talk with her, because that's, you know, that's one thing you learn when you're shooting is you need to stay humble, because there's always somebody that's going to shoot better than you, and probably a lot of people that are going to shoot better than you.
Especially if you're me.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, it's just one of those things. I mean, I don't, you know, nobody, I guarantee you, if somebody's looking at somebody else's target and judging them at the range, then there's something wrong with that person. They need to mind their own business and take care of their own. Because I guarantee you, somebody that's a good shooter is never going to judge somebody else on how well they shoot or not. They're just not going to do it. So,
yes, I think she had an experience. She was at an indoor range and some other gentleman just turned around to her and said, "God, you're shooting terribly." And I think from that point, she said, "Right, I prefer going to the outdoor ranges." Although she didn't quite phrase it that way. She just sort of, do you want to go to an indoor range? No, not really.
Yeah. Well, you know, jerks, what can you do?
Well, exactly.
So, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that happened.
Tag on the score report. So if you want to tell them exactly what to do, you can.
Yeah, that's right.
I do believe it involves flames and physical impossibilities. But anyway.
Ah.
That's right. Yeah, and it's it is harder for women in a lot of cases at a range, because you still have a certain element of you know, the jerk that you know, either A, wants to teach her how to shoot, or B, doesn't think she should be there, and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, fortunately, that's declining, but, you know, it still happens.
Yes. And in fact, I mean, Jay, you've actually stood next to my wife when she's been shooting and shooting a target and seen her ability to shoot. I firmly believe she's a better shot than me.
I remember you came out to the shoot in West Virginia a few years back. I don't recall. I mean, honestly, as long as you're being safe, I really, you know, it's none of my business how you're shooting. I didn't notice anything bad. I don't offer unsolicited advice. If somebody asks me, "Hey, what do you think? What am I doing?" I can guess it, you know, from my own experience of shooting poorly.
Yeah, they would call it Minute of Berm, Grazia for nothing, right?
Absolutely. I can hit the ground every time. That's the only claim I make.
Yeah, but you get an assist for that, so it doesn't really count.
Yeah, it's going to hit the ground eventually, but...
Right.
You know, I honestly do not know what goes through people's minds when they decide that they're going to be the arbiter of, you know, what you should do. Unfortunately, when it comes to the public ranges, particularly indoor ranges, people seem to think that you want their opinion, which is very unusual. You know, it's kind of an unusual thing. Now, I will admit, I do offer unsolicited advice to other drivers on the road. many of them drive in the way that the other person described the shooting, but they really do actually drive terribly, and they need to be told that they're driving terribly.
Yeah, unfortunately, they can't hear you. Actually, maybe when you scream loud enough, maybe they can hear you.
Usually, though, it does affect me because I have to slam on my brakes to avoid hitting them.
Right.
So, you know, if somebody is shooting safely next to me, I really don't care where their rounds are going. I may reference it humorously later on, like the time that I went to an indoor range and the two gentlemen next to me were shooting a rifle at 5 yards and missing the target entirely.
Whoops.
Which I found a little disturbing, but it's not my place to judge. If they enjoy making noise, power to them. God bless them. Buy more ammo.
Maybe they were shooting blanks.
That's about the only thing I could think of. It was interestingly enough, it was a Mosin Nagant too, so they were pretty much touching the target.
So yeah, I was going to say at that range, the muzzle blast will put a hole in the paper.
I was a little you know, confused, but yeah, I don't know. It's not my job. You know, they're having fun. I'm not going to step in and ruin their fun. If they'd said, "Excuse me, sir, we seem to be having trouble," then I might have, you know, looked at it. No, you know, you don't have a front sight. That's the problem, or you know, whatever the case may be. But I'm very much a live and let live kind of person. And unfortunately, it sounds like she ran into a "well there, little lady," which is not as prevalent as it used to be, which that trend is good. There's much less of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of little ladies out there that could school all the guys. So
I've had the very, very exquisite pleasure of watching Julie Golob shoot, and she's quite frankly amazing. And I would not even dream of saying a word other than wow. So
yeah. Can you imagine somebody going up to her and going, "Oh yeah, let me show you how to hold that."
You're holding it wrong. Yeah. Which, by the way, I actually, you know, a humorous aside, I was, you know, one of the things I was thinking is, unless your last name is Michalik, you have no business telling anyone that they don't shoot as good as you. I do remember a video that Jerry Michalik did a few years back where he had two Sig Sauer AR-15 pistols and he had one in each hand and he was, of course, shooting a target at a zillion miles away and hitting the center and because he's Jerry Michalik and I honestly think he's part cyborg. But
he might be.
One of the comments to the video was, "You're holding those pistols like an amateur." And I'm like, really? It's quite possibly, you know, it's certainly top three shooters in the world. You know, top, certainly top 10. I don't know exactly how the rankings go, but in every competition, Jerry's up near the top, and you're telling him that he's holding it wrong.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Because, yeah.
Goodness gracious.
I guess my point is, you can be Jerry Mitchell, like one of the best shooters in the world, and someone will still tell you.
Yeah, somebody's going to tell you you're screwing it up.
You know, take criticism of your shooting ability with a grain of salt, a very large grain of salt, perhaps a pillar of salt, if you will.
So, the Julie and the other gentleman, sorry. Do you think they were born with that skill, or do you think they were taught?
Yes.
Yeah, it's both.
I do think that there's some, you know, just there's some people that have better hand-eye coordination, better eyesight, and that helps.
Yes.
But they've also, I mean, they've both certainly put in the practice. I mean, no question. Just getting out there and doing it. You know, U.S. Olympian Kim Rohde. You know, she just medaled in, I believe, her sixth consecutive Olympics, something that has only been rivaled once in the history of the Olympics. And
But she shoots like 5 hours a day, every day,
right,
to achieve that level of just mastery. It's not even proficiency, it's mastery at that point.
But yeah, sorry, Jay.
No, I was just going to say, you have to put in the work as well as being talented.
I've had this discussion with other people about, you know, other disciplines too, you know, whether it's being a musician or being, you know, anything that requires some talent. You know, you can have no talent in something and work really hard and be okay at it, you know, but you have to work really hard. You cannot be a master without some talent. I mean, there's got to be that something you have that is just required to reach that level. You know, it's like take anything like a you know, Michael Jordan, right? I mean,
yes.
There's no doubt the man is super talented, but he also practiced his ass off, right, to get where he was. You can love basketball. And you can go out and you can practice all day long and you can be a decent basketball player, but you're not going to be Michael Jordan, you know? And that's how it is with guns or anything else. I mean, I'm okay shooting. I'm not horrible, but I'm definitely middle of the pack. You know, I'm not ever going to be, and I'm, you know, I'm okay with that. I can, you know, I go through an IDPA course and I can, you know, I'm not going to be the winner of the course, but all my shots are mostly, you know, in the target and my times are horrible and, you know, okay, fine. It's fun. And, you know, that's how it is. You know, my talents are in other directions.
Yes. Well, you mentioned something, and a thought came to me that obviously professional ballet dancers obviously know where their arms and feet and hands are in relation to space. And I wonder if we trained a ballet dancer how to shoot, if they would be incredibly skilled and proficient.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was a crossover there. I wouldn't be surprised at all. In fact, that's why frequently women are very good shots, because women on average tend to be a little bit better at that sort of thing than men are. I mean, you know, there are men that are really good at it too, but average doesn't apply to individuals, but you know, women seem to have that a slightly better hand-eye coordination in general than men do.
They're also more likely to listen.
Exactly. That's a big thing too.
and not think that they have some innate ability on the Y chromosome that makes them better shots.
Yeah. Yep. That's true. But yeah, I think you have an excellent point, Aiden. I think a good dancer like that or you know, frankly, any good athlete has to have a similar ability. And I think you know, anybody that had good hand-eye coordination and a good sense of, you know, I forget what they call that. There's a word for that, knowing where your body parts are at all the times. And it escapes me at this moment. Anyway, anybody like that would probably be a really good shot if they took the time to practice and learn and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Super duper. Yes. Super please, duper.
Please let us know how your first time shooting your rifle goes. I'm very, very curious.
Yeah, of course it'll be interesting. It'll be like May or, you know, June before it's warm enough to do that.
I can get my wife to take some video and I can share it to the Facebook page.
Yeah. Oh yeah, by the way, Facebook I keep meaning to do this and I keep forgetting. We have the Facebook group. There is a page for the show, a Facebook page, but it doesn't do anything and nobody's on it and there's no activity. So if you do a search for Score Report on Facebook, you might see the page and you might look at it and go, there's nothing there except, you know, show after show after show after show. And it is a good place to go get the shows, but the big activity is the group. And if you do a searching group for SQRPT, you'll find the group. It is a members only group, but that's just so we can ban people that abuse the group. We'll let anybody in, and then you get to screw up and get banned. So all you have to do is request admission, and we will let you in. And it is a very active group. There's lots of people on it, and I don't okay the request. That's a Brita thing. She's the manager of the group, but I see them, and we probably have several a day, you know, lately that people want to join the group, and it's pretty active, and there's lots of interesting posts from people and such. So anyway, that's my group plug.
It is very you're correct, it's very active, and some wonderful people on there. I've made some friends.
Yeah, we, you know, our listeners are mostly decent people, you know. It's I like them. It's actually fun, and I'm a little embarrassed when I hear somebody, oh man, I love the show and I listen to it and all this kind of stuff, and I'm like, oh gee, thanks. You know, I'm like, you know, I don't know, I'm of the Rodney Dangerfield school of, you know, I wouldn't want to be, or who was it, Rodney?
Groucho Marx.
I forget who it was that said I wouldn't be a member of a group that would have me.
Groucho Marx,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't be a member of a group that would have me as a member or something like that. I wouldn't want to join a group that would have me as a member or something. So, I'm always flattered when people say they listen to the show and like it, and so now you mentioned something in an email recently, Hayden.
Yes.
In your role in what you do for a living as a
right,
that you did something with cellular triangulations and stuff like that. I'm always fascinated by what you do. As a forensic examiner, not a dead body forensic examiner, but a dead, more like a dead computer forensic examiner.
Yes. So my career, my job is I'm a digital forensic examiner, and so I worked for and part of how I came into America is I did some work with the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, the BCI, and a part of what I did, not everything, but I did some work with the Internet Crimes Against Children section, and it was an absolutely fascinating time. And so a lot of requests I get now is for digital forensics on mobile devices. In fact, it's almost about the same amount of work as I do on computers and servers, and everything else is now on iPads, tablets, iCloud, social media, and work on that. So I get some requests often for mostly coming from attorneys in for defense cases mobile handheld device triangulation, where a device actually was in time and space when messages were sent or received. I do get a lot of I get a lot of, yes. So I work with some very unique software that I get the data coming from the cell towers. You know, this cell tower received received a signal, and I'm sort of oversimplifying, but received a cell tower strength of, you know, so many dB, and then this cell tower had the same signal, and it also handshook, because they hand the mobile device handshakes with these towers, you see, and the more towers that I can connect a handheld device to, I can then actually geolocate where, you know, where the device is or was at a particular moment in time. And it actually gets quite interesting, because if you have a mountain range, that's perhaps more common in Europe, but if you get a tall building, that actually creates a signal shadow from one cell tower. So whilst a handheld device might actually be closest to one particular mast, the signal is actually reduced from that one because of this sort of shadow, almost like a tree, almost like a tree would cast a shadow from the sun on a playing field.
Right.
It casts a shadow of signal strength, and I'm able to take this raw data and then put it over a compositive map of the actual surroundings, you know, and then say, well, this, you know, even though this handheld device was here at this time, it actually connected to a tower that was further away, and that's how I'm able to sort of say this is where it was in space and time.
So let me see if I can figure. I think I understand how this works, and let me run it past you and see if I'm on track. So I know, you know, you can put your cell phone in field test mode. And if you don't know how to do that, all you have to do is look at do Google a search for your cell phone model in field test mode, and it'll tell you how to do that. And when your phone is in field test mode, what you'll see is a bunch of gobbledygook that means nothing. But if you, again, go on Google, you can find stuff to decode all this. And you'll see things like, tower ID, which tells you what tower you're connected to, and the frequency that it's connected to, and the channel bandwidth, and the signal strength and the noise, signal noise ratio, and all kinds of fun information that is almost meaningless to you as a cell phone user. But what you'll notice is, if you do put your phone in field test mode, is that you will see the phone is actually, in addition to the tower you are talking to when you have a voice conversation, just from the matter of your phone being on, it is pinging the towers around it. And the reason it does that is because the towers have to hand off the signal as you move around. So it can't just talk to one tower. It has to talk to all the towers that it can see. And it makes a judgment call on which one it gets to talk to. That's a handshake between the cellular carrier towers and the cell phone, and a lot goes into that, you know, deciding which one you're going to talk to. It's not just signal strength, but that's the main thing. And so the towers all record your phone's ID number, and it records data like signal strength, and it also records timestamps of these things. And we know that RF being electromagnetic radiation, we know the propagation time in space, free space atmospheric propagation of radio waves. And so based on the timestamp and the frequency and the signal strength and all these other things, you can draw a circle around every tower of the approximate distance from the tower of that phone is. Now, the tower doesn't know necessarily which direction you're on. There are antennas pointed in different directions, and you know they're on different frequencies, so you kind of know it was in this maybe 60 to 90 to 80 degree swath somewhere out there. So you can draw a distant circle around that tower, and then you go to another tower and you draw a distant circle around that tower and another tower. And where those lines cross is the approximate location of the cell phone at that moment in time.
Yes, exactly. And as you're driving down the road, you're either driving closer to one tower, or you're driving further away from a tower. As you are driving away, I see the signal strength decreasing and increasing on the new tower that you're driving towards, and then a third as of yet, tower you have not connected to, waiting for your phone to connect to it. And then obviously it does connect to it. So I can, you know, I can say, you know, you were driving down, you're driving down this road and yes. Or imagine a subway station, you know, New York subway station. You have during rush hour, you know, 3 million people all coming from where there was no reception whatsoever, you know, coming out of the top of the escalator, and, you know, 3,000 devices all of a sudden wanting signal, and therefore, yeah, exactly. And you see, you know, you start seeing connection, you know, you start seeing all these devices, you know, so you can start plotting, you know, people. And and a lot of work I do is text messages, you know, recalling, you know, text messages that have been, you know, been deleted and things like that.
Oh yeah. By the way, people, let me jump in real quick. When you delete a text message from your phone, it's not actually deleted at the carrier. They keep all that stuff. Trust me.
Forever. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Using a cell phone text message to plot your nefarious crimes, that's dumb.
Yes, indeed. I get a lot of work. I get a lot of work from people. I deleted a photograph or I deleted a video or I deleted text messages, they're still there. It's not a huge amount of effort for me to get them back.
Right. Oh man. So what? Okay. So you said you did a lot of, you did some work for the various governments around, and you do a lot of defense work. So what, I mean, without going obviously into details you can't talk about, what is your work more along the lines of proving someone was somewhere or proving they weren't somewhere?
It's a good mixture. I used to work there, and now in the private sector, because I like money.
That's a good reason.
This is scary, but a lot of work I get now is for proving innocence of gentlemen in false rape allegations.
That's very interesting. So someone says that this guy did something somewhere at some time, and he goes, no, I wasn't anywhere near there. And I guess you're using the cell phone records to go, well, yeah, he was at this, his cell phone was connected to this tower 20 miles away at this time. So he couldn't have been there. That sort of thing.
Or, it was a, you know, we had a legitimate relationship, and
I get you.
Yeah.
Here's the text messages from the other party, and you know, okay. That's, yes. I hadn't even thought of that, but yeah, that's a big deal. That's a big deal on colleges now. I see a lot of stuff where, you know, there's the drunken hookup at the you know, frat party or something like that. And then the regretful next morning or a week later or whenever it was, suddenly it becomes, you know, a rape or something like that. I'm not trying to say actual rape doesn't happen by any means, but there is a disturbing amount of false allegations out there.
Yes. Yes. I get cases where people, you know, people have said, "Oh, I've seen certain images on someone's phone," and the person says, "I've never had those type of images on my phone," and I'm able to, you know, to go through and recover all deleted images.
Whoops.
And yeah, And sometimes it exonerates the person, and sometimes it doesn't. Yes.
I bet you've seen stuff you wish you hadn't.
Oh God, yes. Wow. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people don't understand that stuff you put on your phone is not really controlled by you. It's controlled by the phone company and the company that made the phone and the company that made the operating system for the phone. And stuff you do on your phone is not necessarily private. In fact, it almost certainly isn't private in most cases. You got to be real careful about that kind of stuff. I mean, even for like innocent stuff that you may not want, out there. Could be a problem. Like, for instance, say you do your banking from your phone and you have an Android, you have an Android phone that's a couple of years old and you do your banking on it. Well, odds are there's some pretty massive bugs in that several year old version of Android on your phone. And, you download some piece of software from the app store and it happens to carry a rootkit payload or something, and all of a sudden everything you do on your phone is being looked at by, some hacker in Chechnya or something,
There's another factor that I've noticed over my my years in this career is that with mobile phones, because people keep them in their pocket or they keep them in their handbag, and then when they use them, they hold them maybe 6 inches away from their face. They believe that the intimate nature of the information from the screen only has to jump six or seven inches to their eyeballs, that it's therefore more private. It's more it's more intimate. They can have these conversations and they can have these pictures or share these stories on or these life experiences on their phone, because it's only 6 inches away from their eyes. And when it's not 6 inches away from their eyes, it's in their pocket.
Right.
I love people that have phone conversations in the bathroom.
Oh yeah,
I make extra amounts of noise in those cases.
Flush two or three times,
It sounds like the 1812 overture in there when I'm done.
Oh boy! Oh man, that's fascinating, Hayden. I could talk about this stuff for hours. I think, unfortunately, we're
and that's why. Rita on the show is to not have us talk about this for hours.
Right. And,
sorry, Alan.
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
We are. It went by very quickly.
We've hit an hour on the recording meter. So we need to say goodbye. And thank Hayden for stepping in at the last minute and saving our asses with something interesting to talk about.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And, yes, thank you very much for joining in. I really look
up the joint.
To the update. Yes. Well, British joint.
I think that people on the Facebook group, if they, maybe do you want to have guests coming on? Is that
That is actually our intent going forward. We want to have more guests and more interviews with interesting people and conversations and things like this of this nature. Yeah.
Well, perhaps we can, perhaps if people, want to put their hand up metaphorically on the Facebook page, and because I think that would be a wonderful way to.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
Yes.
So yeah, if you want to, don't everybody jump in at once. we do have some standards.
You're very low.
We do insist that you have some sort of Skype capability. We want you to have
a pulse,
a somewhat quiet environment that's not crazy noisy and all that kind of stuff. And One thing that works seems to work really good is a cell phone, a Skype on a cell phone with the earbud mic things. You know, as long as you can keep the mic from rubbing on your beard.
Dope.
And that seems to work pretty good. I don't expect anyone to go out and spend a whole lot of money on a fancy mic and all that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously you can if you want to, but I won't insist on it. Oh, our next show is March 1st. And March is our, how many years, Jay?
15, 17.
Six.
Our sixth. We're in first grade.
Our six-year anniversary is in March.
Wow. So, wow.
Yeah, I know. All right. Well, we'll be back next week, and probably we'll have Brita.
All righty.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.